You know, the smartest people that ever lived, according to historians, were the Athenian Greeks. From them come Socrates and Plato, Aristotle. You know, Plato was Socrates' pupil, and Aristotle was Plato's pupil, and Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander, who did more than anyone who'd ever lived before the birth of Christ to unite East and West. Alexander paved the way for the New Testament gospel. Everywhere he took the Greek conquering armies, as he conquered the world, he said, you must marry with the local girls. And so Greeks married Persians, Greeks married Indians, Greeks married Syrians. And that prepared it for the one world of Christianity because of the spread of the Greek language. When the Romans came, they built on that and they took the roads to spread. So the gospel went very quickly. But it all began with those smart Athenians, the great philosophers of the 6th century BC. But you know, their basic idea was sheer nonsense. And that's why it was when the Peloponnesian Wars came, about 150 years after great philosophers, Athens was decimated. The Peloponnesian Wars proved the fallacy that great education could make great people. Their basic error was that virtue is knowledge, and that knowledge is virtue. That the more good you know, the more good you'll be. It's not true. But it took the world 2.5 millenniums to find out. As a matter of fact, that idea only began to die with World War I, and its complete decease was accomplished by the end of World War II. Never forget, the people that initiated World War I and II were the best educated people in the world. They were the modern Athenians. The main educated people in America were men that went to German universities. PhDs were as common as blackberries when Adolf Hitler launched his blitzkrieg of World War II. Germany was the modern Athens. Virtue is not knowledge, and knowledge is not virtue. Recently I read a review of the works of Thomas Aquinas. He was the greatest medieval writer on religion. And the reviewer said, his works were marvellous, but they were all built on one premise, and it was wrong. Now, Thomas Aquinas has been studied by thousands upon thousands upon thousands of men in the priesthood over 8-year courses. And if they were Jesuits, much longer. Some of us have been accused of being Jesuits, but we weren't at school long enough. The Jesuits go to school for a long, long time. And all that time, they study Thomas Aquinas. But Thomas Aquinas believed that man was primarily a rational creature, which is not true. Man is an emotional creature who sometimes acts rationally. That is true. Man is not a rational creature who sometimes acts emotionally. No, sir. That is not true. Not true at all. Oscar Wilde said, education is a great thing, but nothing important can be taught by it. Oscar Wilde perceived that some of the main things are caught rather than taught. And they are caught through people and experiences with people. Because it is people who interest us. It is people who inflame us. You know, the most important of the sexes spend much of their time talking about people because they have rightly perceived the importance of people. While the other sex may just be talking about the 49ers or something like that. Now, why is it that the Bible does not follow the Greek pattern of just giving us a list of things to know? Why is it the Bible does not seem to depend upon creedal statements? When I was very young, my father used to bribe me by a shilling a book that I read. And he'd bring the books home from the library, books that he found interesting as a man of about 40 to 50 years of age, and he'd give me a shilling to read these books. But there was usually some story element to it, the cruise of the raider Emden or something like that, you know, one of these World War raiders. But when I began to read the Bible at the age of 9, I found it was a book of stories. But when I went to church, and during the dull ritual of the church in the High Anglican Episcopalian service, I would thumb through the prayer book for something interesting. I didn't find any stories. Here's this boy of 9 at church. He couldn't find any stories in the prayer book. But as I kept turning, I came across the 36 or 39 articles of the Creed. Why is it the Bible is not written like that? Why is it that Genesis 1 doesn't begin by saying there's no such thing as an everlasting hellfire, there is no such thing as an immortal soul that can live without a body, the seventh day is the Sabbath, was, is, now, and shall ever be? Why is it that the Bible does not enshrine these great truths in such a way that no one could ever argue. Why not? Very good reason. Very good reason. Come back to education. Come back to the idea that knowledge is virtue and virtue is knowledge. There's been a great deal of work done, as you all know, trying to help people in danger of AIDS. They found for many years that education of the homosexual community was almost powerless to help them about AIDS. Then suddenly the tide turned, and so researchers said, how come? All our education didn't seem to change the life pattern, but it has changed. You know what they found out? When homosexuals were educated as to the risks they laughed, they said, we are invulnerable, or felt so. But by the time they had attended the funeral of 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 fellow homosexuals, they were convinced. We are convinced not by what we hear of idealistic truth. We are convinced by the things that we see worked out in the lives of those that are near to us, or our own life. You've often heard it said, experience is the best teacher. But what else? It's the costliest. It's the dearest. It's the dearest. Wise people learn from the pain of others rather than their own. Having said that, it becomes apparent that we're all a bunch of fools. Because most of us only learn from our own pain. And every one of us can think back on things in their lives. I remember when I was going to a Michigan university about 30 years ago, every day I get severe abdominal pains after the second meal of the day. Week in, week out, month in, month out. Until I read a volume by John Harvey Kellogg, who said, if you are concentrating continually, uninterruptedly, the digestive juices are dissipated, and it may be that when you come to have a meal, if you have been forced in your program to concentrate hour after hour, you can't handle it, and you will get ill. I found if I rested, you see, I used to begin somewhere around 2 a.m, and I'd have about 10 hours of concentration, like that, only breaks of a few minutes walk. One library room to another, one classroom to another, something like that. One book assignment to another. And I found when I changed my program and tried to rest a little before eating, pains went. I was very slow to learn. And I find I'm always slow to learn. I wish I could learn after one mistake. I usually don't. I find in my experience I have to be burnt again and again and again before I wake up. This is why the Bible is full of stories about people. It's enticing us to be wise. In our own experience, we learn that decisions matter. Decisions matter tremendously. How you speak, what you do, how you buy, what you eat, whether you exercise or not. Decisions matter tremendously. This is a life of cause and effect. There is no chance in life. Many things look chance. There is no such thing as chance. Everything's a matter of cause and effect. And therefore, decisions are tremendously important. Life is a matter of sowing and reaping. And the two basic pillars of any successful life is knowing what to do and then being motivated to do it. And the second is the most important. The worst man knows more about duty than the best man does. So motivation is the problem. But stories can save us from going the route of pain and teach us. I spoke at another church recently, for example, about a very great woman, the most influential woman in the world in the first 6 decades. Today, perhaps Mother Teresa is. But I'm thinking of the 2 decades that followed World War I. I'm thinking of the life of a woman, and you'll guess who she was, whose motto could have been this: serenity is the fruit of conquered unhappiness. Her mother died when she was 8. Her father died when she was 10. Her grandmother looked after her, who was terribly strict, terribly legalistic, who dressed her like an old-fashioned child. She She was embarrassed every time she went into society. Life was not easy for this little girl. She was born an ugly duckling. This girl who was to become the most prominent woman in the world was born an ugly duckling. When she was 2, voyaging with her parents across the waters in the Britannica, suddenly the ship was rammed by another one. And all hell broke out on the decks. The child was beheaded by the accident. People died. The crew rushed the lifeboats. The captain had to hold them up with his gun. This little child of 2 found herself being dropped over the side in the waiting hands of her father down there in the lifeboat. And thereafter, when her parents wanted to resume the trip and go to England, she wouldn't go at 2. She wouldn't go. She wouldn't risk the water. And she felt she was rejected when the parents said, "We have to go," because they had a dying son on the other shore that they had to help. She felt she was rejected when they left her, and they left her, she felt, alone and unloved. When the mother returned, her attitude to her daughter was not what it should have been. The mother was a legalistic woman, meant well, never knew the gospel, never loved her own child. This child grew up feeling unloved except by her father. When the little girl would stand outside the room where the mother was with the boys, with one finger in her mouth, the mother would look up and say, "All right, Granny, come in." And the little girl later wrote, when she was a mature woman, "I felt like sinking through the floor when my mother would introduce me to visitors as Granny, Granny." And then she married a very handsome, a very ambitious man, bore his children, repeated pregnancies over a period of 10 years, and having known what it was to be pregnant, be delivered, to care for the infant, be pregnant, be delivered, and care for the infant, over a period of 10 years, suddenly she finds her husband has been unfaithful to her. She offers him his freedom, but he, for political reasons, and for the sake of their children, and because the woman he loved was Roman Catholic, who wouldn't have married him anyway, he decided he would stick with her. She was ever loyal to him, but she said, "I grew up overnight. I grew up overnight." For serenity is the fruit of conquered unhappiness. And so in the years that passed, she aided all his political ambitions when he was stricken with polio, and there's your clue. She became his eyes and ears throughout the whole world. And when she received the message of his death and went to those who were with him, she found out then that the husband who'd promised her 25 years before he would have nothing to do with his former lover, that she had been with him even at the hour of his death. Not immorally, but nevertheless the promise had been violated. She found indeed that members of her own family so schemed it that when she was away, this erstwhile lover was brought back into the picture to dine with the President of the United States. No wonder she said, "I grew up overnight, and I learnt that serenity is the fruit of conquered unhappiness." And Eleanor Roosevelt, in the years that followed, was elected to the UN. She became America's representative throughout the whole world, and she inspired millions of women. Millions of women in every country. She had a heart as big as the world. She was very much a Christian woman. Very much a Christian woman. You cannot read the life of Eleanor Roosevelt without learning some things that will save us much pain. She was a woman that learned to look out despite how she was hurting. She was a woman that decided to concentrate more on duty than on her feelings. And she transformed her life, and to some extent she transformed the world. Another story I told recently, the Sacramento Church was of the young boy who was the age of 8, was sent to a boarding school and was always writing his mother, "Mummy, please come and visit me. Please come and visit me." A week passes. "Mummy, you haven't come. You're always promising you never come. At least let me come home for term end. Mummy, can't I come home? Won't you come and get me? Mummy, I love you, but I never see you." Who was it? Winston Churchill. His mother was a society woman who lived it up. And she neglected Winston Churchill, and steel was built into his soul. The steel that was necessary for World War II, when his great message was, "Never give up! Never give up!" He learned the hard way so that you and I could learn easier. And so the Bible does not tell us repeatedly, be patient. It just tells the story of Job. The Bible doesn't say so much, be faithful. It tells the story of Abraham. The Bible doesn't so much admonish us, be meek. It tells the story of Moses. But it tells each story in such a way that we'll never put trust in ourselves as we're learning. Because where did Job fail? He became impatient. Patient Job failed in patience. And where did Abraham fail? He failed about faith. He told lies repeatedly when his faith failed him. And what about Moses? His meekness dissolved in a time of great irritability. So the Bible tells stories in such a way as to point us to an ideal, but with a warning to remember the clay we are. We're only breathing dust. That's all we are. We are breathing dust and very easily undone. So it's marvelous how the Bible puts these stories in. The Bible just doesn't say don't be covetous, don't be greedy. It tells the story of Achan, and he ends up under a pile of stones. It tells the story of Gehazi, and he carries leprosy with him, and so with all his descendants. It tells the story of Judas, and he goes out and hangs himself. That's much more potent than just being told don't be greedy. The reason the Bible doesn't have creeds is that creeds do not motivate. The Bible is like the living word. God wasn't content with saying be kind, be pure, be true, be truthful. He sent all those things in the living package of flesh and blood. Jesus. The incarnation. Truth was made visible, audible, tangible. A creed is none of those things. So the Bible uses the same principle of incarnation. All the things God wants to warn us about, tell us about, teach us about, he puts them in flesh. So the Bible is a book of stories. All the way through, stories. You see, if the Bible just consisted of two chapters, and imagine what it would have been if a committee had been asked to write it. If it had been a committee of lawyers, it just would have had laws 1 to 30. See? Laws 1 to 30. And laws impossible to keep because you can't do what's right just by being told to do it. Every parent knows that. Children don't learn what to do just by being told to do it. One little girl said to her mother, boy, it's difficult to be good. Mother said, you've only got to make your mind up and do it. Oh, mother, if you had as many minds as I have, you wouldn't say that. That's the trouble with us. We've got so many minds. So many minds. But the Bible is so written that our interests are ours. A sense of dependence is there. And the only truth that sticks is the truth that comes when the whole mind is alerted, and there's a great desire to know, where it's personalized truth. And that's the way the Bible stories lead us. So we find in the Bible not a garden of everything mature and ready to pick, but the Bible is more like a field with all sorts of seeds. And we have to do the sowing, and we have to do the reaping, though the dew comes from God. So the Bible is prepared in such a way that your heart is drawn out in intensity. Lord, help me understand it. Our sympathy is excited when we see what happens to people. Isn't it marvelous that when you read about Nimrod, who built Babylon, founded Assyria, the Bible gives him two verses. Nimrod, you probably can't even remember who it is. That's how little there is. But when you read about the servant of Abraham, there's a whole chapter. You think of what the Bible makes big of. People like Abraham, Lot, Isaac, Jacob, Naomi, Ruth. You know, it illustrates all the phases of life where we find ourselves. Parents, children, workers, employers, see? Mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, son-in-law. All the relationships of life are illustrated in the stories of Scripture, and that has much more potency than saying just children obey your parents. Parents love your children. The Bible does say those things, but it gives much more space to illustrating the picture. Stories move us more because we compare them with our own situation, our own needs. I have often thought how marvelous it is that the first five books of the Bible are mainly concerned with the story of a people. You know, once you get past the first 11 chapters of Genesis, once you get past the first 11 chapters of the Bible, all the rest of the Bible is about Israel. Israel after the flesh, Old Testament. Israel after the Spirit, New Testament. Israel after the Spirit being all those that believe in Jesus. The new covenant's also made with the house of Judah. We're spiritual Jews once we believe in Jesus. See? But after the first 11 chapters, the whole Bible is about stories about Israel. But I've always thought it marvellous that the main section of the first five books of the Bible tells about this nation born in captivity, born in slavery, born in bondage, born in tears, associated with funerals, you know, the murdering of the child that's born at the decree of Pharaoh. And then, lo, a deliverer is raised up, and by the blood of the Lamb, they're delivered, and they go out, and the Red Sea is parted, the things that seem impossible become possible. And when they're starving, God feeds them. When they're thirsty, God gives them drink. When the enemies come, God defends them. And then they go through the wilderness entirely dependent on their deliverer. And they come to a promised land, a land of giants, filled with milk and honey, where there's gold to be dug out and precious stones. It is such a marvelous parable of every believer's life. The story of Israel is everybody's story. We all begin in bondage to bad habits, impurity, gluttony, irritability. You know, we're all born in bondage. Satan is our Pharaoh. Then we learn of Jesus and he delivers us. We go out by the blood of the Lamb. We suddenly find our sins are forgiven. And he opens the Red Sea for us. Things that look impossible become possible. He feeds our soul. He gives us the bread of life. He gives us the water of life. When our enemies come against us, the world, the flesh and the devil, God is sufficient for them. And yet we are in a desert. People who want every satisfaction here, every promise fulfilled here, can never find it. So this is a desert compared with the land whither we go, our heavenly Canaan. So it's marvelous that the great content of the first part of the Bible is just a story that represents our own story. And then if you notice, from the beginning, the Bible is talking about deliverers. The first great character that's brought to view with any great distance of life set out in detail is Abraham. He's a deliverer. He delivers Lot from the kings. Then you can read about Joseph, who delivers the world from hunger. Then you come to Moses, who delivers the nation Israel. Then you come to the book of Judges. That Judges were all deliverers. Samson and Jephthah and Gideon, they're all deliverers. And finally we learn that all this is about another great deliverer. You'll call his name Jesus, for he'll deliver his people from their sins. Same word, you know. Save. Deliver. You'll call his name Jesus. He'll be a deliverer. He'll be a saviour. You find the Old Testament is full of stories of prophets, priests and kings, because one is to come who's the great prophet, the prophet like unto Moses. Unto him you shall hearken. One is to come who's a priest, after the order of Melchizedek. One is to come who's a king, greater than Solomon. So all the stories of prophets, priests and kings are telling us about the great prophet, priest and king. And I want to close with one illustration. Turn with me to the book of Esther, the well-known story there, and observe this closing illustration as to why God gives us stories like Esther rather than a list of 36 articles, or 26, or 27, whichever. You know the story of Esther, but look please at chapter 3. In chapter 3 of Esther, it promotes the story of Haman, verse 1. The king promoted Haman the Agagite, or the Jew that sent shivers down his spine. The Agagites had been their enemies in all generations, and now next to the king is their great enemy. And then in the following verses we read how he hates the Jews. And so in verse 8 he comes to the king and he says, there's a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the peoples and all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They don't keep the king's laws. It's not for the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the Lord the king, let it be decreed they be destroyed, and I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver in the hands of those who have charged the king's business. And so the king says in verse 11, the money is given to you, the people also. Do with them as it seems good to you. The following verses tell us how a decree goes out. Verse 13. To destroy, to slay, to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, and to plunder their goods. And the last part of the chapter says, the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was perplexed. Look at the drama, the tension in the story. Here's a whole nation condemned to death, and the two villainous leaders sit down to drink themselves drunk. But the city has a vague uneasiness. They've heard that it doesn't play to dabble with the Jews. They have heard that the Jews have a God that sometimes intervenes. So the city is perplexed. And then you recall about Esther's experience. In chapter 5, Esther put on her royal robe, stood in the inner court of the king's palace opposite the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne inside the palace, opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight. He held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. It was against the law for Esther to approach unless she was called. She went against the law, and favor was extended to her. There's a sense in which we're all Esthers. We have a law against us if we want to go to the king. The law says, know ye not the unrighteous shall not enter. That's what the law says. The unrighteous shall not enter. 1 Corinthians 6:11. But when we come, the scepter of grace is extended to us because we come through Jesus. And the king extends the grace, contrary to law in one sense, in harmony with it with another. Well, you know what happens. The rest of the story tells how finally the king decides that he will free the people because of Esther. I want you to think of the situation. A nation condemned to death. An immovable lawgiver and an irrevocable law. A death decree. And then the nation is delivered how? They could have gone one by one to the king and said, King, spare us. Didn't work out that way. A representative went to the king. So the story revolves and is given the title of a representative who is the fairest and the foulest of the empire. The fairest, we know that. She's the most beautiful of women. Why the foulest? Because she belonged to a condemned, hated race. Haman would have hated her more than all in the kingdom. So here's one who's the fairest and the foulest. But she represents her people. And because of her, the king overrules the death decree. And the nation is freed, delivered, saved. Now this is the point. Most people among the Jews at the time of the deliverance didn't even know. They knew they'd been condemned to death. They didn't know that they'd been delivered. When the king finally told Esther, I'll save your people. I'll put out another law that says you can defend yourselves and people then won't try to keep the first one. They'll know what I mean by that. You couldn't change the law of the Medes and Persians, but what you could do, you could send out another one that undid it. So he said, I'll send out a law that says I now honor the Jews. They have a right to defend themselves, and no one will touch them. So here is a nation of people, all doomed to die. They knew that. They didn't know that they'd been delivered at the point it happened. It took time for that word to get out. Dear friends, do you see the meaning of the story? You and I are Israel. We've all been condemned to death. We've all been condemned to death. I was recently doing some filing, a very rare thing for me. I always comfort myself with HMS Richards' comment. When he introduced a man to a group of workers, he said, this man's an expert on filing. He knows more about filing than anyone in the world. But you've never heard of him because all he does is file. I've decided not to be in that category, and I've paid the price dearly. But anyway, in doing some filing recently, I came across some letters from some very gracious people who at different stages of my life have been a great help to me. There was a conference president who put to the division they ought to send their sport overseas when I came to this country. There was a man at the seminary that sent back to Australia and said, listen, it's madness sending this boy to do a BD. He's got to do a PhD. There were letters from a man in England by the name of F.F. Bruce, who was so very gracious to me before he ever met me. And I was going through these old letters. And then as I was walking later, it suddenly occurred to me, most of the people whose letters I just handled were dead. Now dead. And you and I write letters. And our letters will outlast us. Our letters will outlast us. You see, we are all under the decree of death. We're only growing in one direction. It's not younger. Whatever people say, it's not younger. We're all under the decree of death, see? That we know. But the second point is, dear friends, the Jews had been delivered through their representative and did not know it when it happened. They didn't know it. It had happened in the courts of the king. The decision had been made. Esther, I'll give you the lives of your people. So the nation out there was now free, but they did not know. Isn't that the situation with the world? The world's been delivered. While we were yet sinners, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son. The whole world has been reconciled legally by the death of Christ. It's not sin that excludes people from heaven, it's unbelief. They've all been delivered, but they don't know. What's our message? Go and tell them. Go and tell them that they may gladly and happily embrace it. In other words, dear friends, the message of this book is that we have a wonderful inheritance secured for us by our great representative. It's there. And the gospel is just the announcement. Will you not come? Will you not receive it? Now that'll move the heart. A creed could never move the heart. How infinitely wise our God is. He does all things well.